nor heard of. And what would we have to do with mortals now? You are the first we have seen in a long age.
The Count of Nad Mullach waited for Yisvidri to continue. When it appeared he would not, Eile asked,
Mortals, like us? What mortals do they name to you? The Zedaya woman, first grandmother, as she is called, spoke several times of,
the Dwaro conferred briefly with his fellows,
of Handless Joshua.
Handless? Gods of earth and stream, do you mean Joshua lack hand?
Eile stared, astounded.
Oh, heaven, this is madness.
He sat down heavily on one of the decaying benches. Maegwin slumped beside him. Her mind was already reeling beneath such weariness and disappointment that she had no strength left to be surprised. But when she at last turned away from the mild, wide eyes of the puzzled Dwaros to look to Eolair, the Count's face was that of a man struck by lightning in his own house. Simon awakened from a flight through black spaces and screaming winds. The howling continued, but a red light bloomed before his eyes as the darkness receded.
Vren, you little fool! Someone was shrieking close by. There is blood in the circle!
When he tried to take a breath, Simon felt something pushing down on him, so that his lungs had to strain for air. He wondered briefly if a roof had fallen on him.
Fire? The red light danced and billowed. Was the hayholt on fire?
He could see a vast shape now, dressed in flapping white. The figure seemed to have grown tall as the trees, looming far into the sky. It took long moments before he realized he was lying on the icy ground, that Skodi was standing over him, screaming at someone.
How long?
The little boy Vren flailed on the ground a few cubits away, his hands holding his throat, eyes bulging in his dark face. Untouched and unapproached, he was kicking his feet wildly, heels drumming on the frozen mud. Somewhere nearby, Kantaka was mournfully howling.
You are bad,
Skodi screamed, her face gone pinkish-purple with rage.
Bad, Vren, spilled blood, they will swarm, bad,
she gasped in a great breath and bellowed.
Punishment!
The little boy writhed like a smashed snake. Beyond Skodi, a shadowy face watched from the center of the rippling fire, its unstable mouth moving in laughter. A moment later, the bottomless black eyes settled on Simon, their sudden touch like an icy tongue pressed against his face. He tried to scream, but some great weight was pushing on his back.
Little fly, a voice whispered in his head, heavy and dark as mud.
It was a voice that had haunted many dreams, a voice of red eyes and burning darkness.
We meet you in the strangest places, and you have that sword as well. We must tell the master about you. He will be very interested.
There was a pause. The thing in the fire seemed to grow larger, the eyes cold black pits in the heart of an inferno.
Why, look at you, man-child,
it purred.
You are bleeding.
Simon drew his shaking hand out from beneath his body, wondering why it seemed strange that it should respond to his will. When he disentangled it from Thorn's hilt, he saw that the trembling fingers were indeed covered with slick red blood.
Punished!
Skodi was shrieking, her childlike voice cracking.
Everyone will be punished! We were to give presents to the Lord and Lady.
The wolf howled again, closer. Vren had gone limp, face down in the mud at Skodi's feet. As Simon stared distractedly, the ground seemed to bulge, obscuring his view of the boy's pale, crumpled form. A moment later, another bulge appeared close by, quivering. The half-thawed earth parted with a crunching, sucking sound. A thin, dark arm and long-nailed hand lifted from the agitated soil, reaching toward the dim stars with fingers spread like the petals of a black flower. Another hand snaked up beside it, followed by a pale-eyed head scarcely bigger than an apple. A needle-toothed grin split the wizened face, twitching the scraggly black whiskers. Simon squirmed, unable to cry out. A dozen bulges blistered the earth of the courtyard, then a dozen more. In a moment, the diggers were seething up from below like maggots from a burst carcass.
"Borken!" Skodi shrilled in alarm. "Borken! Vren, you little fool! I told you not to spill blood in the charm circle!"
She waved her fat arms at the diggers, who swarmed over the shrieking children like a plague of chittering rats.
"I punished him!"
she screamed, pointing at the unmoving child.
"Go away!"
She turned to the bonfire.
"Make them go away, sir! Make them go away!"
The fire fluttered in the chill wind, but the face only watched.
"Help! Simon!"
Benedict's voice was hoarse with fear.
"Help us! We are still tied!"
Simon rolled over painfully, trying to pull his knees beneath him. His back was clenched in an immovable knot, as though he had been kicked by a horse. The air before his eyes seemed full of shining snowflakes.
"Benabek," he groaned.
A wave of squealing black shapes split off from the main cluster, flowing away from the children and toward the abbey wall where Sludig and the troll lay.
"Stop! I will make you!"
Skodi had clamped her hands over her ears, as though to shield herself from the children's pitiful screams. A small foot, pallid as a mushroom, emerged briefly from the knot of diggers, then was swallowed up again.
"Stop!"
The ground suddenly erupted all about her, gouts of gelatinous mud spattering her nightdress. A flurry of spidery arms wrapped around her broad calves, then a swarm of diggers were climbing her legs as though they were tree trunks. Her nightdress bulged as they swarmed up beneath it in ever-increasing numbers until at last the thin fabric split like an overstuffed bag, revealing a squirming mass of eyes and scrawny legs, and taloned hands that almost completely obscured her doughy flesh. Skodi's mouth pulled wide to scream, and a serpentine arm pushed into it. Disappearing to the shoulder, the girl's pale eyes bulged. Simon had finally dragged himself into a half-crouch when a grey shape flashed past him, bowling into the slithering, squeaking mass that had been Skodi and tumbling it to the ground. The digger's mewing cries rose in pitch, quickly becoming trills of fear as Kantaka snapped necks and crushed skulls, throwing small bodies in the air with gleeful abandon. A moment later she was through and racing toward the throng of creatures that had descended on Binnabik and Sludik. The fire had flared up to a great height. The unformed thing within it laughed. Simon could feel its terrible amusement sapping him, sucking the life from him.
"This is amusing, little fly, is it not? Why don't you come closer, and we will watch together?"
Simon tried to ignore the pull of the voice, the insistent power of its words. He clambered agonizingly to his feet and staggered away from the fire and the thing that lurked within it. He used Thorn as a crutch, propping himself, though the hilt slid treacherously beneath his blood-damped hand. The slash Vren had made across his back was a cold ache, a numbness that was still somehow painful. The thing Skodi had summoned continued to taunt him, its voice echoing inside his head, playing with him like a cruel child with a captured insect.
"Little fly, where are you going? Come here, the master will want to meet you."
It was a terrible struggle to keep walking in the other direction. Life seemed to be running out of him like sand. The digger's squeals and Kantaka's wet, joyful growl had become no more than a faint roaring in his ears. For a long moment he did not even notice the talons grasping at his legs. When at last he looked down into the spider-egg eyes of the Buchan, it was as though he stared through a window into some other world, a horrible place that was fortuitously separated from his own. It was not until the scrabbling claws began to shred the legs of his breeches and score the flesh beneath that the dreamlike state fell away. With a shout of horror, he smashed the wrinkled face with a bald fist. More were climbing his legs. He kicked them away with moans of disgust, but they seemed as numberless as termites. Thorn shivered again in his hands. Without thinking, Simon lifted it and sent the black blade whistling into a clump of prancing creatures. He felt it hum, as though it sang silently. Grown marvelously light, Thorn sheared heads and arms like grass stems until dark ichor ran down the blade in streams. Every swing sent fiery pain lancing through Simon's back, but at the same time he felt mad exhilaration course through him. Long moments after all the diggers around him had died or fled, he was still hacking at the tangled corpses.
"My, you are a fierce fly, aren't you? Come to us."
The voice seemed to reach into his head as into an open wound, and he squirmed in disgust.
"Tonight is a great night, a wild night."
"Simon!"
Benevik's muffled cry at last cut through his frenzy of hatred.
"Simon, unbind us!"
"You know we will win, little fly. Even at this instant, far away in the south, one of your greatest allies falls, despairs, dies."
Simon turned and staggered toward the troll. Kantaka, her muzzle blood-washed to the ears, was keeping a hopping, shrilling throng of diggers at bay. Simon lifted Thorn once more and began to cut his way through the buchan, smashing them down in bunches, until at last they scattered from his path. The voice in his head seemed to be crooning almost wordlessly. The fire-washed courtyard shimmered before his eyes. He bent to cut the troll's bonds, and a great wave of dizziness almost toppled him to the ground. Binnebik rubbed the rope against Thorn's cutting edge for a moment until the pieces fell aside. The little man tried briefly to rub life back into his wrists, then turned to Sludig. After picking at the knot for a moment, he turned to Simon.
"Here, lend your sword to this cutting,"
he began, then stared.
"Choco stones! Simon, you are all of blood on your back."
"Blood will open the doorway, man-child. Come to us."
Simon tried to speak to Binnebik, but could not. Instead, he thrust Thorn forward, clumsily pinking Sludig's back with a point. The Rimmer's men, coming slowly back to wakefulness, groaned.
"While he slept, they struck his head with a stone,"
Binnebik said mournfully.
"Because of his bigness, I am thinking. Me, they only tied."
He sawed Sludig's bonds against Thorn until they too fell slithering to the snowy ground.
"We must be reaching the horses,"
the troll said to Simon.
"Have you sufficient strength?"
He nodded. His head felt far too heavy for his neck, and the roaring in his thoughts was giving way to a frightening emptiness. For the second time that night, he felt his inner self beginning to float free from its confining shell, but this time he feared there would be no returning. He forced himself to remain standing as Binnebik coaxed the bleary Rimmersman to his feet.
"The master is waiting in the chamber of the well."
"All we may do is run for the stables,"
Binnebik shouted over the wolf's menacing snarl. She had forced the diggers back so that several yards of open ground stood between the ring of buchan and Simon's friends.
"With Kantaka leading, we can perhaps be getting there. But we must not slow or hesitate."
Simon swayed. "Get the saddlebags," he said, "in the abbey." The little man stared at him incredulously.
"Foolishness!"
"No," Simon shook his head drunkenly. "I won't go without White Arrow. She... they won't take that." He stared out across the dooryard at the heaving mass of diggers gathered where Skodi had stood.
"You will stand before the singing harp. You will hear his sweet voice."
"Simon!"
Binnebik began, then briefly swung his hand in the Canuck ward against madmen.
"You are barely able for standing,"
he grunted.
"I will go."
Before Simon could respond, the troll vanished through the door into the abbey's lightless interior. Long moments later, he returned, dragging the saddlebags behind him.
"We will hang most on Sludig,"
Binnebik said, eyeing the waiting diggers apprehensively.
He is too full of sleepiness to fight, so he will be our pack ram.
Come to us.
As the troll draped the bags over the bemused rimmersman, Simon looked out at the circle of pale, naked eyes. The waiting diggers clicked and chittered quietly as though talking among themselves. Many wore tatters of crude clothing. Some had rough, jagged-bladed knives clutched in their spindly fists. They stared back at him, swaying like rows of black poppies.
"Are you now ready, Simon?"
Binnebik whispered. Simon nodded, lifting Thorn beside him. The blade had been light as a switch, but now it suddenly seemed heavy as stone. It was all he could do to hold it before him.
"Nihut Kantaka!"
the troll shouted. The wolf sprang forward, jaws wide. Diggers piped in fear as Kantaka ploughed a furrow through flailing arms and gnashing teeth. Simon followed, swinging Thorn heavily from side to side, to side to side.
"Come! There are endless cold halls below Nakika. The lightless ones are singing, waiting to welcome you. Come to us."
Time seemed to fold in on itself. The world closed down into a tunnel of red light and white eyes. The throb of pain in his back seemed to grow as rhythmic as his heartbeat, and the aperture of his vision alternately spread and shut as he stumbled forward. A roar of voices as continuous as the sea washed over him, voices both within and without. He swung the sword, felt it bite, then shook it free and swung again. Things reached for him as he passed, some caught and tore at his skin. The tunnel narrowed to black for a while, then opened up for a few moments sometime later. Sludig, who was saying words too quiet for Simon to hear, was helping him up onto Homefinder's back, pushing Thorn through the saddle loops. They were surrounded by stone walls. But as Simon drove his heels into his horse's ribs, the walls were suddenly gone, and he was beneath the tree-slashed night sky, the stars glimmering overhead.
"Now is the time, man-child. The door is opened by blood. Come, join us in our celebrations."
"No," Simon heard his own voice shouting. "Leave me alone." He spurred ahead, leaping out into the forest. Binnebik and Sludig, not yet mounted, shouted after him, but their words were lost in the din inside his head.
"The door is open. Come to us."
The stars were speaking to him, telling him to sleep, that when he awoke he would be far away from eyes in the fire, from Skodi, from clawing fingers, from he would be far away from
"The door is open. Come to us."
He rode heedlessly through the snowy woods, trying to outrun the terrible voice. Branches tore at his face. Stars peered coldly down through the trees. Time passed, perhaps hours, but still he rode wildly onward. Homefinder seemed to feel his frenzy. Her hooves flung clouds of snow as they pounded through the darkness. Simon was alone, his friends far behind, but still the fire thing spoke gleefully inside his thoughts.
"Come, man-child. Come, dragon-burned. It is a wild night. We await you beneath the ice mountain."
The words in Simon's head were a swarm of fiery bees. He writhed in the saddle, striking at himself, slapping at his ears and face as he tried to drive the voice away. Even as he flailed, something loomed abruptly before him. A patch of blackness, deeper than the night. In a split instant he felt his heart falter, but it was only a tree. A tree! His headlong flight was too madly swift to avoid the obstacle. He was struck as though by a giant hand and thrown from Homefinder's saddle, tumbling through nothingness. He was falling. The stars were fading. Black night came down and covered all. Chapter 17. A Wager of Little Value. The afternoon had worn away. The wind-scoured sky stretched above the grasslands, like a purple awning. The first stars were coming out. Deornoth, wrapped in a coarse blanket against the chill, stared up at the faint points of light and wondered if God had finally turned away his face. Joshua's people were huddled together in a bull run, a long narrow pen of wooden palings driven deep into the earth and lashed together with rope. For all their seeming flimsiness, in many places there were gaps so wide that Deornoth could slip through his entire arm and most of his shoulder. The walls were strong as mortared stone. As he looked around at his fellow prisoners, Deornoth's gaze stopped on Jaloe. The witchwoman held Leleth in her lap, singing quietly into the child's ear as they both stared up at the darkening sky. "It seems madness that we should escape from Norns and Diggers to end here." Deornoth could not keep an aggrieved tone from his voice. "Jaloe, you know charms and spells. Could you not have magicked our captors somehow? Put them to sleep or turned yourself into a ravening beast and attacked them?" "Deornoth," Joshua said warningly, but the forest woman needed no defending.
"You understand little," said Deornoth, "of how the art works,"
Jaloe replied sharply.
"First of all, what you call magic has its cost. If it could be easily used to defeat a dozen armed men, the armies of princes would be full of hired wizards. Secondly, we have not been harmed yet. I am no Priorities. I do not waste my strength in puppet plays for the bored and curious. I have a greater enemy to occupy my thoughts. More dangerous by far than anyone in this encampment."
As if giving such a long answer exasperated her, and indeed Jaloe seldom said so much at once, she fell silent, turning away to stare at the firmament once more. Frustrated with himself, Deornoth shrugged off his blanket and stood. Had it come to this? What sort of knight was he that berated an old woman for not saving him from danger? A shiver of anger and disgust traveled through him. He clenched and unclenched his fists helplessly. What could he do? What strength did any of this ragged band have left to do anything? Isorn was comforting his mother. Duchess Gutrun's remarkable courage had held through any number of horrors, but she seemed to have reached her limit. Sangfugl was crippled. Towser had virtually given in to madness. The old man lay curled on the ground, his eyes fixed witlessly on nothing, seamed lips trembling as Father Strangyard tried to help him drink from a bowl of water. Deornoth felt another wave of despair rise and break within him, as he walked slowly to the muddy log on which Prince Joshua sat, chin on hand. The manacle that had once prisoned him in Elias's dungeon still dangled on the prince's slender wrist. Joshua's thin face was painted with deep shadows, but the whites of his eyes gleamed as he watched Deornoth slump down beside him. For a long while, the two did not speak. The sounds of lowing cattle and the shout and clatter of horsemen could be heard all around as the Thrything's men brought in their herds for the night.
"Well-a-day, friend," the prince said at last. "I said it was a poor game at best.
Did I not?"
"We have done what we could, Highness. No one could have done more than you."
"Someone has."
For a moment, Joshua seemed to regain his dry humor. "He is sitting on his skeletal throne in the Hayholt, drinking and eating before a roaring fire, while we sit waiting in the slaughter pen."
"He has made a foul bargain, Prince. The king will regret his choice."
"But we, I fear, will not be around when the reckoning comes."
Joshua sighed.
"I am almost sorriest for you, Deornoth. You have been the most faithful of knights. If you had only found a better lord to be faithful to."
"Please, Highness."
In his present mood, such words brought Deornoth real pain.
"There is no one I would rather serve outside the kingdom of heaven."
Joshua looked at him from the sides of his eyes, but did not reply. A party of horsemen rode past the stockade, the palings rippling as the horses thundered by. We are far from that kingdom, Deonov, the prince said at last. But at the same time, only a few breaths away. His face was now hidden in darkness. But death frightens me little. It is the hopes I have crushed that weigh down my soul.
Joshua,
Deonov began, but the prince's hand on his arm stilled him. Say nothing. It is no more than the truth. I have been a lodestar for disaster since the moment I drew breath. My mother died birthing me, and my father's greatest friend, Camaris, died soon after. My brother's wife died in my care. Her only child has escaped my guardianship. To suffer, Aiden only knows what fate. Naglamund, a keep built to hold siege for years, fell beneath me in weeks. Countless innocents died horribly.
I cannot listen to this, my prince.
Would you take all the world's betrayals on your own back? You did everything that you could.
Did I?
Joshua asked seriously, as though he debated a point of theology with the Osirian brothers. I wonder. If things are fated, then perhaps I am merely a sorry strand in God the Highest's tapestry. But some say that one chooses everything, even the bad.
Foolishness!
Perhaps. But there is no doubting that an evil star has hung over all I have undertaken. How the angels and devils both must have laughed when I swore I would take back the dragonbone chair. Me, with my ragtag army of priests and jugglers and women. The prince laughed bitterly. Deonoth felt anger boiling inside him once more. But this time it was his liege lord who was the cause. It was almost breathtaking. He had never thought he could feel like this.
My prince, he said between clenched teeth. You have become a fool, a damnable fool. Priests, jugglers, and women, an army of mounted knights could scarcely have done more than your women and jugglers, and certainly could not have been braver.
Shaking with fury, he rose and stalked away across the muddy compound. The stars seemed almost to tilt in the sky. A hand closed on his shoulder, pulling him around with surprising strength. Joshua stood stiffly as he held Deonoth at arm's length. The prince jutted his head forward on his long neck, a bird of prey preparing to stoop. And what have I done to you, Deonoth, that you speak so to me? His voice was tight. At any other moment, Deonoth would have fallen to his knees, ashamed at his own disrespectfulness. Now he stilled his trembling muscles and took a breath before he spoke.
I can love you, Joshua, yet hate what you say.
The prince stared at him, his expression indecipherable in the evening dark. I spoke badly of our companions. That was wrong. But I said nothing ill of you, Sir Deonoth.
Elysia, Mother of God, Joshua!
Deonoth almost sobbed.
I care nothing for myself!
And as for the others, that was only a careless remark that you made, out of weariness.
I know you meant nothing by it. No, it is you who are the victim of your own cruelest treatment. That is why you are a fool.
Joshua stiffened.
What?
Deonor threw his arms up in the air, filled with the sort of giddy madness felt on Midsummer's Eve, when all wore masks and told the truth. But here in the Bull Run there were no masks.
You are a better enemy to yourself than Elias can ever be,
he shouted, not caring any more who heard.
Your blame, your guilt, your failed duty?
If Osiris Aiden were to return to Navan today and again be hung on the tree in the temple garden, you would find a way to blame it on yourself.
No matter who is speaking the evil, I will listen to a fine man slandered no longer.
Joshua stared as if stunned. The terrible silence was broken by the creak of the wooden gate. Half a dozen men with spears pushed into the stockade, led by the one named Hotvig, who had captured them on the Imstrecker's banks. He strode forward, peering around the shadowed pen.
Joshua, come here.
What do you want? The prince asked quietly.
The March Thane has called for you. Now!
Two of Hotvig's men moved up, lowering their spear points. Leonath tried to catch Joshua's eye, but the prince turned away and walked out slowly between the two Thrithings men. Hartvig pulled the high gate shut behind them. The wooden bolt creaked back into place.
"You don't think that they will harm him, do you, Deonoth?"
Strangyard asked.
"They wouldn't hurt the prince, would they?"
Deonoth sank down onto the muddy ground, tears rolling down his cheeks. The interior of Fikolmage's wagon smelled of grease and smoke and oiled leather. The March Thane looked up from his joint of beef to nod Hotvig back out the door, then returned his attention to his meal, leaving Joshua to stand and wait. They were not alone. The man standing beside Fikolmage was half a head taller than Joshua, and only slightly less muscled than the broad March Thane himself. His face, clean-shaven but for long moustaches, was covered with scars too regular to be accidental. He returned the prince's stare with undisguised contempt. One hand, clatteringly laden with bracelets, dropped to caress the hilt of his long, curved sword. Joshua held this one's narrowed eyes for a moment, then casually allowed his glance to slide away, taking in the vast array of harnesses and saddles hanging from the wagon's walls and ceiling, their myriad silver buckles glittering in the firelight.
"You have discovered some of the virtues of comfort, Fikolmage," Joshua said, eyeing the rugs and stitched cushions scattered over the floorboards.
The March Thane looked up, then spat into the fire trough.
"I sleep beneath stars, as I always have, but I need someplace safe from listening ears."
He bit at the joint and chewed vigorously.
"I am no stone dweller, who wears a shell like a soft-skinned snail."
A piece of clanking bone rattled into the trough. "It has been some time since I have slept behind walls or in a bed myself, Fikolmage. You can see that.
Did you bring me here to call me soft? If so, have done, and let me go back to my people. Or did you bring me here to kill me? The fellow beside you has somewhat the look of a head chopper."
Fikolmage dropped the denuded bone into the fire and grinned hugely, his eyes red as a boar's.
"You don't know him? He knows you, don't you, Utvard?"
"I know him,"
he had a deep voice. The March Thane now leaned forward, peering at the prince intently.
"By the four-footed," he laughed. "Prince Joshua has more grey hairs than old Fikolmage. Living in your stone houses makes a man old first."
Joshua smiled thinly. "I have had a difficult spring."
"You have! You have!"
Fikolmage was enjoying himself immensely. He picked up a bowl and tilted it to his mouth.
"What do you want of me, Fikolmage?"
"It is not me that wants Joshua, despite your sin against me. It is Utvard here."
He nodded at his glowering companion.
"We spoke of age. Utvard has only a few years less than you. But he does not wear a man's beard. Do you know why?"
Utvard stirred, rubbing his fingers on his pommel.
"I have no wife," he rumbled.
Joshua looked from man to man, but said nothing.
"You are a clever man, Prince Joshua," Fikolmage said slowly, then took another long draught. "You see the problem. Utvard's bride was stolen. He has sworn never to marry until the one who stole her is dead."
"Dead?"
Utvard echoed. Joshua's lip curled.
"I stole no one's bride. Vosheva came to me after I had left your camp. She begged to go away with me."
Fikolmage slammed the bowl down, splashing dark beer into the fire trough, which hissed as if startled.
"Curse you! Did your father have no male children? What true man hides behind a woman or allows one to have her way? Her bride's price was set. All was agreed. Vosheva had not agreed.
The March Thane rose from his stool, staring at Joshua as though the prince were a poisonous serpent. Fakolmage's corded arms trembled.
You stone dwellers are a pestilence. One day the men of the free Thrithings will drive you into the sea and burn away your rotting cities with clean fire.
Joshua eyed him evenly. The men of the Thrithings have tried that before. It is how we met, you and I. Or have you forgotten the uncomfortable fact of our alliance? An alliance against your own people. Fakolmage spat again, and this time did not bother to aim for the trough.
It was a chance to increase my strength. It worked. I stand today unquestioned lord of the High Thrithings.
He stared at Joshua as if daring him to argue.
Besides, that treaty was with your father, for a stone dweller. He was a mighty man. You are a thin shadow of him.
Joshua's face was empty. I'm tired of talking. Kill me if you wish, but do not bore me. Fakolmage leaped forward. His broad fist crashed against the side of Joshua's head, and the prince crumpled to his knees.
Proud talk, worm! I should kill you with my own hands!
The March Thane stood over Joshua, his barrel chest heaving.
Where is my daughter?
I don't know. Fakolmage grabbed Joshua's tattered shirt and pulled the prince onto his feet. Watching, Utvard swayed gently from side to side, his eyes dreamy.
And you don't care either, do you? By the Grass Thunderer, I have dreamed of smashing you, dreamed of it. Tell me of my Vorsheva, child-stealer. Did you at least marry her?
A bleeding welt showed at Joshua's temple. He stared back.
We did not wish to marry.
Another blow rocked the prince's head. Blood started from his upper lip and nose.
How you laughed at old Fakolmage when you sat in your stone house, eh?
The March Thane hissed.
Stole his daughter and made her your whore. Then did not have to pay a single horse for her. You laughed, didn't you?
He slapped hard at the prince's face. Pearls of blood flew through the air.
You thought you could cut off my stones and run away.
The March Thane struck again, but though fresh blood seeped from Joshua's nose, this blow was softer, dealt with a kind of savage affection.
You are clever, Lackhand, clever. But Fakolmage is no gelding. Vorsheva is no whore.
Fakolmage propelled him back against the wagon's door. The prince left his arms dangling, making no attempt to defend himself as he was struck twice more.
You stole what was mine!
Fakolmage snarled, his face so close to Joshua's that his braided beard rubbed on the prince's bloody shirt front.
What would you call her, then? What did you use her for?
Joshua's red smeared face, despite his injuries, had been full of a terrible calmness. Now it seemed to break apart, dissolving into grief.
I used her badly.
He hung his head. Utvard strode forward, drawing his sword from its tooled and beaded scabbard. The tip clicked against a ceiling beam.
Let me kill him,
he breathed.
Slow.
Fakolmage looked up, eyes squinting fiercely. Sweat dripped from his face as he looked from Utvard to Joshua, then lifted his thick-knuckled fist over the prince's head.
Let me,
Utvard pleaded. The March Thane hammered three times against the wall. The harnesses swayed, tinkling.
Hartvig,
he roared. The wagon door opened. Hartvig entered, pushing a slender figure before him. The pair stopped just within the doorway.
You heard all,
Fakolmage bellowed.
You betrayed your clan and me. For this!
He gave Joshua's shoulder a push. The prince fell back against the wall and slid to the floor. Vorsheva burst into tears. Hartvig's restraining hand held her back as she leaned forward to touch the prince. Joshua slowly lifted his head, staring at her distractedly, from eyes that were beginning to swell shut.
You are alive, was all he said.
She tried to pull away from her captor, but Hotvig grasped her close, ignoring the nails that raked at his arm, leaning his head away when she tried to reach his eyes.
Rand Warders caught her in the utter grazing march,
Fekolmich growled. He slapped at her lightly, angered by her struggling.
Be still, you faithless bitch! I should have drowned you in the Umstreha at birth. You are worse than your mother, and she was the evilest cow I have ever known. Why do you waste your tears on this piece of dung?
He prodded Joshua with his foot. The prince's absorbed look had returned. He regarded the Marchthane with dispassionate interest for a moment, before turning to Vosheva. I am glad you are safe.
Safe? Vosheva laughed shrilly. I love a man who does not want me. The man who does want me would use me like a brood mare and beat me if I ever left my knees.
She struggled in Hotvig's grasp, turning to face Utvat, who had lowered his sword to the floor.
Oh, I remember you, Utvat. Why did I run away, except to get away from you, you raper of children? And of young sheep when you cannot get a child. You, who love your scars more than you ever could a woman. I would rather be dead than your bride.
Grim-faced Utvat said nothing, but Fekolmich snorted in dour amusement.
By the four-footed, I had almost forgotten that jagged knife you have for a tongue, daughter. Maybe Joshua here is happy to feel the blows of fists for a change, eh? As for what you prefer, kill yourself the moment the marriage rite is over if you wish. I only want my bride price, and the honor of the stallion clan made good.
There are better ways to do that than slaughtering helpless prisoners,
a new voice said. All heads turned, even Joshua's, though he moved carefully. Jaloi stood in the doorway, arms spread to the lintel, cloak rippling in the wind.
They have escaped from the bull run, Fekolmich shouted wrathfully. Don't move, woman! Hotvig, settle and bring the rest back. Someone will howl for this.
Jaloi stepped into the wagon, which was rapidly becoming crowded. With a muffled curse, Hotvig pushed past her and out into the darkness. The witch woman calmly pulled the door closed behind him.
He will find them, still penned, she said. Only I can come and go as I please.
Utvat lifted his broad blade and held it near her neck. Jaloi's hooded yellow eyes touched his, and the tall Thrithings man stepped back a pace, brandishing the sword as though he were menaced. Fekolmich looked her up and down with puzzlement and guarded anger.
What is your business, old woman?
Released from Hotvig's grip, Vosheva had dropped to her knees and crawled past her father to dab at Joshua's face with her tattered cloak. The prince gently caught her hand, holding it away as Jaloi spoke.
I said, I come and go as I please. For now, I choose to be here.
You are in my wagon, old woman.
The Marchthane wiped sweat from his forehead with a hairy arm.
You thought to hold Jaloi, your prisoner. Fekolmich, that was foolish. Still, I have come to give you advice, in hopes that you have more sense than you have shown so far this day.
He seemed to fight an urge to strike out once more. Seeing his struggle, his strained look, Jaloi nodded her head and smiled grimly.
You have heard of me?
I have heard of a devil woman with your name, one who lurks in the forest and steals the souls of men,
Fekolmich grunted. Utvat stood close behind him, mouth set in a tight line, but the tall man's eyes were wide and shifted as though he were made certain of where the doors and windows were.
You have heard many false rumors, I am sure,
Jaloi said.
But there is some truth behind them, however twisted it may have become. That truth is in the tales that say, I make a bad enemy, Fekolmich.
She blinked slowly. as an owl blinks when it catches sight of something small and helpless.
A bad enemy.
The March Thane pulled his beard.
I do not fear you, woman, but I do not trifle with demons needlessly.
You are no use to me. Go away, then, and I will not trouble you. But do not meddle in what does not concern you.
Fool of a horse lord.
Jaloe flung up her arm, cloak trailing like a black wing. The door burst open behind her. The wind that swept in extinguished the lamps and plunged the wagon into near darkness, leaving only the fire glowing scarlet in its trough like a door into hell. Somebody cursed fearfully, barely audible above the moaning inrush.
I told you, Jaloe cried. I go where I please.
The door swung shut again, although the witch woman had not moved. The wind was gone. She leaned forward so that her yellow eyes reflected restless flames.
What happens to these people does concern me, and concerns you as well, although you are too ignorant to know it. Our enemy is your enemy, and he is greater than you can understand, Vikornich. When he comes, he will sweep across your fields, like a grass fire.
Ha!
The March Thane smirked, but the nervous edge was not gone from his voice.
Do not preach to me. I know all about your enemy, King Elias. He is no more a man than Joshua here. The Thriving's men do not fear him.
Before Jaloe could respond, there was a rap at the door, which swung open to reveal Hotvig, bearing his spear and a puzzled expression. He was only a young man, despite his heavy beard, and he regarded the witchwoman with undisguised dismay as he spoke to his chieftain.
The prisoners are still in the bull run. None of the men outside saw this one leave. The gate is locked, and there are no holes in the fence.
Fekolmich grunted and waved his hand.
I know.
The March Thane's gaze shifted to Jaloe for a brooding moment. Then he smiled slowly.
Come here,
he ordered Hotvig, then whispered into the rider's ear.
It will be done,
Hotvig said, darting a nervous glance at Jaloe before going out again.
So,
Fekolmich said, and smiled broadly, showing most of his crooked teeth.
You think I should set this dog free to run away?
He shoved Joshua with his foot, earning a swift glare of hatred from his daughter.
What if I do not?
He asked cheerfully. Jaloe narrowed her eyes.
As I told you, March Thane, I make a bad enemy.
Fekolmich chortled.
And what shall you do to me when I have told my men to kill the remaining prisoners unless I come to them myself before the next watch of the night to say otherwise?
He patted his hands on his belly in contentment.
I do not doubt you have charms and spells that can harm me. But now our blades are at each other's throats, are they not?
In the corner of the wagon, Utvart growled, as if excited by the image invoked.
Oh, horse lord, may the world be preserved from such as you,
Jaloe said disgustedly.
I hoped to convince you to help us, which would be for your good as much as ours.
She shook her head.
Now, as you say, our knives are out. Who knows if they may be put away without causing many deaths?
I do not fear your threats,
Fekolmich growled. Jaloe stared at him for a moment, then looked at Joshua, who was still seated on the floor, watching all that transpired with odd placidity. Lastly, she turned her gaze on Utvart. The tall man scowled fiercely, not at all comfortable under her scrutiny.
I think there is still one favor I can do for you. March Thane Fekolmich.
I need no
quiet,
Jaloe shouted. The March Thane fell silent, bawling his fists, his reddened eyes bulging.
You
are about to break your own laws, she said. The laws of the High Thrythings. I will help you avoid that.
What madness are you speaking, devil woman? He raged. I am the lord of the clans.
The clan councils honor no man as March Thane who breaks their old laws, she replied. I know this. I know many things.
With a sweep of his arm, Fekalmich sent a bowl flying from atop his stool to clatter against the wagon's far wall.
What law? Tell me what law, or I will throttle you even though you burn me to ashes.
The laws of bride price and betrothal.
Jaloi pointed at Joshua.
You would kill this man, but he is her betrothed. If another,
she indicated brooding Utfat,
wishes to have her, he must fight for her. Is that not true, Thane?
Fekalmich smiled, a great rancid grin that spread across his face like a stain.
You have outsmarted yourself, meddler. They are not betrothed. Joshua admitted that from his own lips. I would break no law to kill him. Utvard stands ready to pay the bride price.
Jaloi looked at him intently.
They are not married, and Joshua has not asked her. This is true. But have you forgotten your own customs, Fekalmich, of the Stallion clan? There are other forms of betrothal.
He spat.
None but fathering.
He broke off, forehead wrinkling in a sudden thought.
A child.
Jaloi said nothing. Vosheva did not look up. Her face was hidden by her dark hair, but her hand, which had stroked the prince's bloodied cheek, froze like a snake-startled rabbit.
It is true,
she said finally. Joshua's face was a complicated puzzle of emotions, made even harder to read by the elaborate tracing of bruises and weals.
You... how long have you known? You said nothing. I have known since just before Naglamund fell,
Vosheva said.
I feared to tell you.
Joshua watched the tears cutting new tracks along her dusty cheeks. He lifted his hand to touch her arm briefly, before allowing it to drop back into his lap. Then looked from Vosheva up to Jaloi. The witchwoman held his eye for a long moment. Some communicated thought seemed to pass between them.
By the four-footed,
Fekalmich growled at last, bemused.
A child betrothal, is it? If it's even his, that is.
It is his, you pig,
Vosheva said fiercely. It could be no one else's. Utvard stepped forward, boot buckles chinking. His sword point thumped down into the floorboard, sinking half an inch into the wood.
A challenge, then,
he said.
To the death we fight.
He looked to Jaloi, and his expression became cautious.
Vosheva, the March Thane's daughter, she is spoils.
Turning back to the prince, he tugged his sword free. The great curved blade came loose as lightly as a feather.
A challenge.
Joshua's eyes were hard as he spoke through torn lips.
God hears.
Deonoth stared down at his prince's battered features.
In the morning? He cried,
loud enough to draw a scowl from one of the guards. The Thrything's men, bundled in heavy woolen cloaks against the chill, did not look pleased with their assignment in the windy bull run.
Why do they not just kill you cleanly?
It is a chance, Joshua said, then surrendered to a fit of coughing.
What chance?
Deonoth said bitterly.
That a one-handed man who has been beaten bloody can get up in the morning and outfight a giant? Merciful Aiden, if I could only get my hands on that snake for Colmage.
Joshua's only reply was to spit bloodily into the mud.
The prince is correct,
Jaloi said.
It is a chance. Anything is better than nothing.
The witchwoman had returned to the bull run to tend the prince. The guards had stepped back quickly to let her pass. Something of her nature had travelled through the camp in swift whispers. Fakolmage's daughter had not come with her. Vosheva had been locked in her father's wagon, tears of sorrow and anger still damp on her face.
"But you had him at a disadvantage," Deonoth said to the witchwoman. "Why did you not strike then? Why did you let him send guards?"
Jaloa's yellow eyes glittered in the torchlight.
"I had no advantage at all. I told you once," said the Omnath, "I cannot make warlike magic. I escaped this stockade, yes. But other than that, it was all bluff. Now, if you will be silent about what you do not know, I will put my true skills to their proper use."
She returned her attention to the prince.
"How did she escape the stockade?"
Deonoth could not help wondering. One moment Jaloe had been wandering in the shadows at the far end of the bull run. The next, she had been gone. He shook his head. It was useless to argue, and he had been little else but useless of late. He touched Joshua's thin arm.
"If I may be of any help, my prince, only ask."
He dropped to his knees, then looked briefly to the witchwoman.
"I apologize for my unthinking words, Velada Jaloe."
She grunted an acknowledgement. Deonoth rose and walked away. The rest of the starveling band was seated by the other fire. The Thrything's men, being not entirely without mercy, had given them brush and twigs with which to build it. They were not merciless, Deonoth thought, but not stupid either. Such poor fuel would provide heat, barely, but could not be used as a weapon, as could a flaming brand. The thought of weapons set him to musing as he seated himself between Sangfugal and Father Strangyard.
"This is a foul way to end things," he said.
"You have heard what has happened to Joshua?"
Strangyard swung his slender hands.
"They are untutored barbarians, these grasslanders. Mother Elysia, I know all men are equal in God's eyes, but this is atrocious. I mean to say, even ignorance is not an excuse for such..."
He trailed off fretfully. Sangfugal sat up, wincing at the pain in his leg. Anyone who knew him would have been astonished. The harper, previously meticulous in grooming and dress, almost to the point of comedy, was as ragged, soiled, and burr-covered as a haystack vagabond.
"And if Joshua dies," he said quietly,
"he is my master, and I love him, I suppose, but if he dies, what happens to us?"
"If we are lucky, we will be little better than slaves," Deonoth said, hearing his own words as if from another's lips. He felt quite hollow. How had things come to such a point? A year earlier, the world had been as regular as supper bread. "If we are unlucky," he continued, but did not finish his thought, nor did he need to.
"It will be worse on the women,"
Sangfugal whispered, looking over to Duchess Guthrum, who held sleeping Lelith on her lap.
"These men are ungodly brutes. Have you seen the scars they give themselves?"
"Isorn," Deonoth called suddenly.
"Come here, if you please."
Jukas Grimnor's son crawled around the meager fire to sit near them.
"I think," Deonoth said, "that we must prepare ourselves to do something tomorrow when Joshua is made to fight."
Strangyard looked up, worried.
"But we are so few. Half a dozen in the midst of thousands."
Isorn nodded, a grim little smile showing on his wide face.
"At least we can choose the way we die. I will not let them have my mother."
The smile vanished.
"By Osiris, I swear I would kill her first."
Sangfugal looked around as if hoping they would reveal their joke.
"But we have no weapons," he whispered urgently. "Are you mad? Perhaps we might live if we do nothing, but if we make trouble, we will certainly die."
Deonoth shook his head.
"No, Harper. If we do not fight, we will certainly be less than men, whether they kill us or not. We will be less than dogs.
who at least rip the bear's guts as he kills them. His gaze traveled from face to face. Sangfugo, he said at last, we must plan. Why don't you sing a song against the chance of any of these cowherders wondering why we are gathered or what we speak of? A song? What do you mean? A song, a long, boring song about the virtues of quiet surrender. If it comes to an end and we are still talking, begin again. The harper was plainly agitated. I know no tune like that.
Then make one up, songbird,
Isorn laughed.
We have been too long without music anyway. If we die tomorrow, we should live tonight.
Make it a part of your plans if you will, Sangfugl said. That I would prefer not to die at all. He sat up straighter and began to hum tunelessly, searching for words. I am frightened, he said at last.
So are we, Deonoth replied.
Sing.
Fakolmij swaggered into the bull run soon after dawn touched the grey sky. The March Thane of the High Thrithings wore a heavy embroidered wool cloak and a rugged gold stallion on a chain around his neck, trotted out of the paddock, followed closely by three of his guard. Deonoth, who had watched the whole exchange, cursed quietly. He knew what effort it had taken his prince to act so unconcerned. He and Isorn had helped Joshua climb to his feet in the hour just before first light. Even after the healing draught Jaloi had given him, an unmagical concoction to bolster Joshua's strength, Jaloi had bitterly regretted the lack of a sprig of mockfoil to make it truly efficacious. The prince had still found it difficult to dress himself. The beating Fakolmij had given him had taken a terrible toll on his undernourished frame. Deonoth secretly doubted that Joshua would even be able to stand after swinging a blade for a short while. Father Strangyard approached the prince.
Your Highness, is there truly no other way? I know the Thrithings men are barbaric, but God despises none of his creations. He has put the spark of mercy in every breast. Perhaps.
It is not the Thrithings men who wish this, Joshua told the one-eyed priest kindly. It is for Cornish. He bears an old hatred for me and my house, one that even he will not fully admit.
But I thought the Stallion clan fought for your father in the Thrithings War, Isorn said. Why should he hate you?
Because it was with my father's help that he became War Thane of the High Thrithings. He cannot forgive the fact that it was the Stone Dwellers, as he calls us, who gave him the power his own people would not. Then his daughter ran from him, and I took her with me, losing him a bride price of horses. To our friend the March Thane, that is a terrible dishonor. No, there are no words, priestly or otherwise, that will make Fakolmij forget. Joshua took a last look at Nadel's keen blade, then slid it back into its sheath. He gazed around at his assembled people.
Heads high, he said.
The prince seemed strangely clear-eyed and cheerful. Death is no enemy. God has prepared a place for us all, I am sure. He walked to the gate in the fence. Fakolmij's guards opened it, then formed a spear-bristling escort as Joshua walked across the wagon city. A swift, cool breeze was blowing across the grasslands, an invisible hand that ruffled the meadows and thrummed in the tent lines. The low hills were dotted with grazing cattle. Scores of grimy children who had been dodging in and out among the wagons left their games to follow Joshua and his makeshift court as they trudged toward the March Thane's paddock. Deonoth looked at the faces of children and their parents as they came to join the swelling procession. Where he expected to see hatred or bloodlust, he found only eager expectancy. The same eagerness he had seen as a child on his brothers' and sisters' faces, when the High King's Guard or a painted peddler's wagon had passed their Huanshire freeholding. These people hoped only for some excitement. It was unfortunate that it would take somebody's death, most likely that of his beloved prince, to provide it. Golden ribbons flapped on the fence posts of Fakalmage's enclosure, as if this were a festival day. The March Thane sat on a stool before his wagon door. Several more bejeweled Thrithing's men, other clan leaders Deonoth guessed, were seated on the ground beside him. Several women of various ages stood nearby, and one of them was Vorsheva. The March Thane's daughter no longer wore the rags of her court dress. She had been dressed in a more traditional clan costume, a hooded wool dress with a heavy belt studded with colourful stones, and a band across her forehead that tied at the back of her hood. Unlike the other women, whose bands were of dark hues, Vorsheva wore a white ribbon, no doubt indicating, Deonoth reflected sourly, a bride for sale. As Joshua and his followers stepped through the gate, the prince and Vorsheva caught each other's eyes. Joshua deliberately made the sign of the tree on his chest, then kissed his hand and touched it to that spot. Vorsheva turned away, as if to hide tears. Fakalmage stood and began to speak to the assembled crowd, slipping back and forth between Westerling and the harsh Thrithing's dialect as he held forth to the seated dignitaries and the other clan folk gathered around the paddock fences. As the March Thane roared on, Deonoth slipped forward between the half-dozen spearmen who had followed Joshua into the enclosure and moved to his prince's side. "Highness," he said quietly, laying a hand on his shoulder. The prince started, as if woken from a dream. "Ah, it's you. I wanted to beg your forgiveness, my prince, before whatever happens. You are the kindest lord a man could want. I had no right to speak to you as I did yesterday." Joshua smiled sadly. "You had every right. I only wish I had more time to think about the things you said. I have indeed been far too self-absorbed of late. It was the act of a friend to point that out." Deonoth fell to a knee, pulling Joshua's hand to his lips. "The Lord bless you, Joshua," he said quickly. "Bless you, and do not close too swiftly with that brute." The prince thoughtfully watched Deonoth rise. "I may have to. I fear I have not the strength to wait long. If I see any chance at all, I must take it." Deonoth tried to speak again, but his throat was too tight. He clasped Joshua's hand, then retreated. A ragged volley of shouts and cheers rose from the crowd as Utvard climbed over the paddock fence and took his place before Fakalmage. Joshua's adversary stripped off his cowhide vest and displayed his muscular torso, which had been rubbed with fat until it glistened. Seeing this, Deonoth frowned. Utvard would be able to move quickly, and the fat would help him keep warm. The Thrithing's man's curved sword had been thrust scabbardless through his broad belt, his long hair pulled into a knot at the back of his head. Utvard wore a bracelet on each arm, and several earrings dangled against his jaw. He had daubed his scars with red and black paint, making himself seem a kind of demon. Now he pulled his sword from his belt and lifted it over his head, engendering another chorus of shouts.
"Come, Blackhand," he boomed. "Utvard is waiting."
Father Strangyard was praying aloud as Joshua walked forward across the enclosure. Deonoth found that rather than soothing or reassuring him, the priest's words rubbed on his nerves until he had to step away. After a moment's consideration, he moved to a spot along the fence just to the side of one of the guards. He looked up and saw Isorn staring. Deonoth shifted his chin in a virtually undetectable nod. Isorn eased over toward the wall also, until he stood a few yards from Deonoth. Joshua had left his cloak with Duchess Gutrun, who cradled it like a child. Beside her stood Leleth, dirty fist clutching the Duchess' tattered skirt. Jaloe was a short distance away, her yellow stare hooded. As Deonoth surveyed the group, other eyes met his and slid away, as if fearing to maintain too lengthy a contact. Sangfugl quietly began to sing.
So, son of Prester John, you come before the free folk of the Thrivings a little less great than you once were.
Fakalmich grinned. His clansmen laughed and whispered. Only in my possessions, Joshua said calmly. As a matter of fact, I would like to propose a wager, Fakalmich. Between the two of us, you and me. The Marchthane laughed, surprised.
Brave words, Joshua. Proud words coming from a man who knows he will soon die.
Fakalmich looked him over calculatingly.
What kind of wager?
The prince slapped his scabbard. I propose to bet on this and my good left hand.
Good, since it is your only hand,
Fakalmich smirked. His clansmen roared.
That is as may be. If Otvat defeats me, he gets Vosheva and you get her bride price. Is that not true?
13 horses.
The March Thane was smug.
What of it?
Simply this. Vosheva is already mine. We are betrothed. If I survive, I gain nothing new. His eyes met Vosheva's across the crowd of watchers, then moved back to her father with cold regard.
You gain your life,
Fakalmich spluttered.
In any case, it is foolish to talk. You will not survive.
Otvat, waiting impatiently, allowed himself a thin smile at his thane's words.
That is why I wish to make a wager with you, Joshua said. With you, Fakalmich. Between men.
Some of the clansmen chuckled at this. Fakalmich looked around angrily until they fell silent.
Speak on.
It will be a wager of little value, Fakalmich. The kind that bold-willed men make without hesitation in the cities of my people. If I win, you will give me the same price you are asking from Utvard.
Joshua smiled.
I will choose 13 horses from you.
There was an undertone of anger in Fakalmich's hoarse voice.
Why should I wager with you at all? A wager is only a wager if both sides risk something. What could you possibly have that I want?
His expression turned cunning.
And what do you have that I cannot simply take from your people when you are dead?
Honor.
Fakalmich drew back in surprise. The whispers around him intensified.
By the four-footed, what does that mean? I care little for your soft-hearted stone dweller's honor.
Ah, Joshua said with a ghost of a smile. But your own?
The prince turned suddenly to face the crowd of Thrivings folk who hung over the fences of Fakalmich's great paddock. A ripple of quiet talk ran through the throng.
Free men and women of the High Thrivings, he cried. You have come to see me killed.
A bray of laughter greeted this statement. A clod of dirt hurtled toward Joshua, missing him by only a few cubits and rolling past Fakalmich's clansmen, who glared out at the assembly.
I have offered your March Thane a wager. I swear that the Aiden, god of the Stone Dwellers, will save me, and that I will beat Utvat.
That would be something to see,
one of the crowd bellowed in heavily accented Westerling. There was more laughter. Fakalmich stood and moved toward Joshua as if to silence him, but after looking around, the shouting spectators seemed to think better of it. Instead, he crossed his arms over his broad chest and watched sullenly.
What do you wager, little men?
One of the clansmen near the front shouted.
All that remains to me, my honor, and the honor of my people.
Joshua drew Nadal from its sheath and lifted it high. His shirt sleeve fell back. Elias' rusted manacle, which he still wore around his left wrist, caught the faint morning light like a band of blood.
I am the son of Prester John, the High King who you remember well.
Fakalmich knew him best of all of you,
the crowd murmured. The March Thane growled his discontent at this show.
Here is my wager,
Joshua shouted.
If I fall to Utvat, I swear it will prove that our god Osiris Aiden is weak, and that Fakolmij speaks true when he says that he is stronger than the stone dwellers. You will know that your March Thane stallion is mightier than the dragon and tree of John's house, which is the greatest house in all the city lands of Ostenard. A chorus of shouting voices rose. Joshua calmly surveyed the crowd.
What does Fakolmij wager?
Someone cried at last. Odvard, standing only a few ells away, was glowering at Joshua, obviously furious at how his thunder had been stolen, but just as obviously unsure as to whether Joshua's wager could somehow increase his own glory when he slaughtered this crippled city dweller. As many horses as Vorshaver's bride price, and my people and I to go free and unhindered, Joshua said. Not much when matched against the honor of a prince of Erkinland.
A prince with no house, someone
catcalled, but a host of other voices drowned out the heckler, exhorting Fakolmij to take the wager, crying that he would be a fool to let this stone dweller show him up. The March Thane, features twisted in poorly hidden rage, let the crowd's urgings wash over him like rain. He looked quite ready to grasp Joshua's neck in his hands and throttle the prince himself.
So, it is done, he snarled at last, lifting his arm in a gesture of acceptance.
The watchers cheered.
By the grass, Thunderer, you have heard him. The wager is set. My horses against his empty words. Now, let this foolishness come to a swift end.
Much of the March Thane's enjoyment seemed to have evaporated. He leaned forward, speaking low so that only Joshua could hear.
When you are dead, I will kill your women and children with my own hands, slowly. No man makes me butt of a joke before my clans and steals my rightful horses.
Fakolmij turned and stalked back to his stool, frowning at the jests from his Rand warders. As Joshua unbuckled and cast away his sword belt, Utvard stepped forward, corded arms gleaming as he lifted his heavy blade.
You talk and talk and talk, little man,
the grasslander snarled.
You talk too much.
A moment later, he bounded across the intervening space in three long strides, his sword swinging in a great arc. Nadel flashed up, deflecting the blow with a dull chime. But before Joshua could bring his slim blade up for a cut of his own, Utvard had whirled and began another powerful two-handed sweep. Joshua again managed to sidestep Utvard's attack, but this time the curved sword rang hard against the prince's guard, and Nadel almost flew from his hand. He staggered back a few steps across the muddy turf before he could regain his balance. Utvard grinned fiercely and began circling, forcing Joshua to turn quickly so the prince could keep his left shoulder facing the Thriving's man. Utvard fainted, then lunged. Joshua's boot heel slid on the hoof-trampled ground, forcing him to drop to one knee. He managed to turn Utvard's thrust, but as the big man pulled his blade free, it soared back across Joshua's sword arm, freeing a ribbon of blood. The prince rose carefully. Utvard showed his teeth and continued circling. A trickle of red dripped from the back of Joshua's hand. The prince wiped it on the leg of his breeches, then raised it again quickly as Utvard feigned another thrust. Moments later, the blood was again dribbling down Joshua's wrist and onto his hilt. Deonor thought he understood the strange business of the wager. Joshua was hoping to make Fakolmij and Utvard angry in the hope it would lead to some sort of mistake. But the prince's idea had all too obviously not succeeded. The March Thane was indeed furious, but Joshua was not battling Fakolmij, and Utvard did not seem as hot-headed as the prince had probably hoped. Instead, the Thriving's man was proving himself a canny fighter. Rather than relying blindly on his superior strength and reach, he was wearing Joshua down with heavy blows, then springing away before the prince could counter. As he watched the one-sided combat, Deonath felt his heart falling like a stone. It had been foolish to think anything else could happen. Joshua was a fine swordsman, but he would have had trouble with one like Utvard at the best of times. Today, the prince was injured and poorly rested, weak as a stripling.
It was only a matter of time. Deonoth turned to Isorn. The young Rimmer's man shook his head grimly. He too understood that Joshua was fighting a defensive action, putting off the inevitable as long as possible. Isorn lifted his eyebrow inquiringly. Now? Father Strangyard's murmured prayers were a counterpoint to the shouting throng. The guards around them were staring raptly, eyes wide, spears held only loosely. Deonoth lifted his hand. Wait. Blood was running from two more wounds, a slash on Joshua's left wrist and a broad gouge in his leg. The prince wiped sweat from his forehead and left a broad scarlet smear across his face, as though he sought to match Utvart's painted scars. Joshua stumbled back, ducking awkwardly beneath another of Utvart's swinging attacks, then tensed and lunged forward. His thrust ended harmlessly, well short of Utvart's oiled stomach. The Thriving's man, silent to this point, laughed harshly and cut again. Joshua blocked, then attacked. Utvart's eyes widened, and for a moment the paddock echoed with the percussive sound of steel on steel. Most of the throng were up and shouting. Slender Nadel and Utvart's long sword spun in and out through an intricate dance of silver light, ringing their own accompaniment. The Thriving's man's mouth stretched in a grimace of wild glee, but Joshua's face was ashen. His bloodless lips pursed, and his grey eyes burning with some last reserve of strength. Two of the Thriving's man's powerful swings were clangingly rebuffed. Then Joshua's swift lunge drew a bright red line along Utvart's ribs. Some in the watching crowd shouted and clapped at this evidence that the fight was not yet over, but Utvart narrowed his eyes in anger and surged forward, raining blows like a blacksmith hammering at an anvil. Staggered, Joshua could only retreat, trying to keep Nadel up before him, the thin strip of steel his only shield. The prince's weak attempt at a counter-thrust was carelessly knocked aside. Then one of Utvart's bludgeoning swipes banged off the prince's guard and struck his head. Joshua lurched backward for several loose-jointed steps, before slumping to his knees, blood coursing from a spot just above his ear. He lifted Nadel before him as though to ward off more blows, but his eyes were bleary, and the sword wavered like a willow limb. The noise of the throng rose to a howl. Fikomage was on his feet, beard blowing in the sharp wind, clenched fist in the air like an angry god calling down the thunder of the heavens. Utvart approached Joshua slowly, still surprisingly cautious, as though he expected some stone-dweller trick. But the prince was clearly beaten, struggling to rise from his knees, the stump of his right wrist slipping in the mud. A different kind of noise suddenly arose from the far side of the paddock. The crowd's attention grudgingly turned toward the source. There was an eddying of bodies near where the prisoners stood, and spears flailing like grass stems. A woman's shriek of amazement was followed immediately by a man's cry of pain. A moment later, a pair of bodies broke free from the press. Deonoth held one of the Thriving's guards, his elbow around the man's throat. The knight's other hand clasped the guard's spear just below the head, its sharp point pushed snug against the man's belly. "Tell your other riders to send back, horse lord, or these men will die!" Deonoth prodded at his captive's belly. The man grunted but did not cry out. A spot of blood appeared on his dun-colored shirt. Fikomage stepped forward, flushed with wrath, his braided beard quivering on his jaws.
"Are you mad? Are you mad, men? By the four-footed, I will crush you all!
Then your clansmen will die as well. We do not like to kill in cold blood, but we will not stand by and see our prince murdered after you beat him until he could not fight."
The crowd murmured unhappily, but Fikomage, seething with rage, paid no attention. He raised his braceleted arm to call for his warriors, but a voice lanced out,
"No!"
It was Joshua, climbing totteringly to his feet.
"Let them go, Deonoth!"
The knight stared in amazement.
"But, Highness, let them go!"
He paused to find breath.
"I will fight my own battle. If you love me, release them."
Joshua rubbed blood from his eyes, blinking. Deonoth turned to Isorn and Sankfugl, who held spears on three more guards. They returned his astonished stare.
"Release them," he said at last. "The prince bids us release them."
Isorn and Sangfugl lowered their spears, allowing the Thriving's men to step away. They promptly did, scrambling out of reach of the spear points before they remembered their original roles as captors and stopped, muttering angrily. Isorn ignored them. Beside him, the harper was trembling like a wounded bird. Jiloe, who had not moved through all the furore, shifted her yellow eyes back to Joshua.
"Come, Utvat," the prince said haltingly, his smile a bitter slash of white across a bloody mask. "Forget them. We are not finished."
Fekolmidge, who stood close by, champing with his open mouth as though at a bit, started to say something. He never had the chance. Otvart leaped forward, battering at Joshua's guard. The moment's respite had not returned Joshua's strength. He fell backward unsteadily before the Thriving's man's attack, fending off the curved blade only by the slimmest of margins. At last, a swinging blow slid past, nicking Joshua's chest. Then the following attack landed the flat of Utvat's blade on Joshua's elbow, springing Nadel from his grasp. The prince scuttled after it, but as his fingers closed on the bloody hilt, his feet slipped from beneath him, and he sprawled on the trampled turf. Seeing his advantage, Utvat lunged forward. Joshua was able to lift his sword and turn the stroke downward, but his awkward position as he rose from the ground allowed Utvat to grapple him in a hugely muscled arm and begin to pull the prince in toward the cutting edge of the curved sword. Joshua brought up his knee and right arm to try to hold his attacker at bay, then managed to raise his other arm, keeping his blade locked against Utvat's guard. But the stronger Thriving's man pushed his sword up slowly against the prince's stiffened wrist, forcing Nadel back as the crescent blade rose toward Joshua's throat. The prince's lips skinned back in a grimace of ultimate exertion, and sinews knotted along his slender arm. For a moment, his supreme effort halted the rising blade. The two men stood grappling chest to chest. Sensing the prince's flagging strength, Utvat tightened his grip around his smaller foe and smiled, drawing Joshua toward him in a movement almost ritually slow. Despite the agonized play of the prince's muscles, the long edge of the curved blade continued inexorably upward, coming lovingly to rest against the side of Joshua's throat. The crowd stopped shouting. Somewhere overhead a crane threw out its clattering call, then silence swept back over the field.
"Now," the Thriving's man exulted, breaking his long silence. "Utvat kills you."
Joshua suddenly ceased resisting and flung himself forward into his enemy's grasp, snapping his head to one side. The curved blade slid along the outside of his neck, slicing the flesh deeply, but in that fractional instant of freedom, the prince drove a knee into Utvat's groin. As Utvat grunted in painful surprise, Joshua hooked a foot around the Thriving's man's calf and pushed against him. Utvat could not find his balance and tumbled backward. Joshua fell with him, the Thriving's man's blade flailing past his shoulder. When Utvat struck the ground with a hiss of released breath, Nadel snaked free. A moment later, its point slid beneath the Thriving's man's chin and was hammered upward a hand's width or more, through the jaw and into the brain case. Joshua rolled himself free of Utvat's spastic clutch and struggled to his feet, dripping scarlet. He stood for a moment, legs shaking, arms dangling limp and helpless, and stared at the body on the ground before him.
"Tall man," he gasped. "It is you who talks too much."
A moment later, his eyes rolled up beneath his lids, and he fell heavily across the Thriving's man's chest. They lay together, their blood commingling, and across the entire grasslands, it seemed that nothing spoke or moved for a long time. Then the shouting began. Part 3. Storm's Heart. Chapter 18. The Lost Garden. After a long sojourn in soundless velvet emptiness, Simon returned at last to the dim borderlands between sleep and waking. He came to awareness in darkness on the edge of dream, and realized that once again a voice was speaking within his thoughts,
as on the nightmarish flight out of Skodi's Abbey. Some door had been opened inside him. Now it seemed that anything might enter. But this uninvited guest was not the taunting flame thing, the Storm King's minion. The new voice was as different from that ghastly other as the quick from the dead. The new voice did not mock or threaten. In fact, it did not even seem to be speaking to Simon at all. It was a womanly voice, musical yet strong, shining in Simon's lightless dream like a beacon. Though its words were sorrowful, it brought him a strange sense of comfort. Even though Simon knew that he slept, and was sure that it would only be the work of an instant to wake into the real world, the voice captivated him so that he did not wish to awaken just yet. Remembering the wise, beautiful face he had seen in Jiriki's mirror, he was content to hover on the edge of wakefulness and listen, for this was the same voice, the same person. Somehow, when that door into Simon had been opened, it was the mirror woman who had come through. Simon was infinitely thankful for that. He remembered a little of what the Red Hand had promised him, and even in the shelter of sleep he felt frost upon his heart.
"Beloved Ekatri, my beautiful son," the woman's voice said, "how I miss you. I know you are beyond hearing or beyond replying, but I cannot help speaking as though you were before me. Too many times have the people danced the year's end since you went into the west. Hearts grow cold, and the world grows colder still."
Simon realized that even though the voice sang through his dream, these words were not meant for his ears. He felt like a beggar child spying on a rich and powerful family through a crack in a wall. But just as the wealthy family might have sorrows a beggar could not understand, miseries unrelated to hunger or cold or physical pain, so the voice in Simon's dream, for all its majesty, seemed weighted with quiet anguish.
"In some ways, it seems only the turning of a handful of moon faces since the two families left Venia Dose, the land of our birth across the great sea. Ah, Hakatri, if only you could have seen our boats as they swept across the fierce waves. Of silverwood they were crafted, with sails of bright cloth, brave and beautiful as flying fish. As a child, I rode in the bow as the waves parted, and I was surrounded by a cloud of scintillant, sparkling sea foam. Then, when our boats touched the soil of this land, we cried. We had escaped the shadow of unbeing and won our way to freedom. But instead, Hakatri, we found that we had not truly escaped shadow at all, but only replaced one sort with another, and this shadow was growing inside us. Of course, it was long before we realized it. The new shadow grew slowly, first in our hearts, then in our eyes and hands. But now, the evil it caused has become greater than anyone could have suspected. It is stretching across all this land that we loved, the land to which we hastened long ago, as to the arms of a lover, or as a son to the arms of his mother. Our new land has become as shadowed as the old one, Hakatri. And that is our fault. But now your brother, who was ruined by that shadow, has himself become an even more terrible darkness. He casts a pall over all he once loved. Oh, by the garden that is vanished, it is hard to lose your sons."
Something else was now competing for his attention. But Simon could only lie helplessly, unwilling or unable to waken. It seemed that somewhere outside of this dream that was not a dream, his name was being called. Did he have friends or family who searched for him? It did not matter. He could not break away from the woman. A terrible sadness twisted within him, like a sharpened stick or a bit of broken pot. It would be cruel to leave her alone with her sorrow. At last, the voices that faintly called for him vanished. The woman's presence remained. It seemed that she wept. Simon did not know her, and could not guess to whom she spoke, but he wept with her. Guthwulf was feeling confused and irritated. As he sat polishing his shield, he tried to listen to the report of his castellan, who had just ridden down from Guthwulf's hold in Utanyit. He was not having much luck with either chore. The earl spat citral juice into the floor rushes.
"Say it again, man. You are making no sense at all."
The castellan, a round-bellied, ferret-eyed fellow, firmly repressed a sigh of weariness. Guthwulf was not the kind of master before whom one displayed imperfect patience, and started in again on his explanation.
"It is simply this, lord. Your holdings in Utanyit are nearly empty. Wolfholt is deserted but for a few servants. Almost all the peasants have left. There will be no one to bring in the oats or barley, and harvest can wait little more than a fortnight." "My serfs have left?"
Guthwulf stared distractedly at the boar and silver spears that sparkled on his black shield, the spearheads picked out in mother of pearl. He had loved that coat of arms once, loved it as he would a child.
"How do they dare leave? Who but me has fed the ugly louts of all these years?" "Well, hire others for harvest, but do not let those who fled come back again. Not ever."
Now the castellan did make the smallest noise of despair.
"My lord, Earl Guthwulf, I fear you have not been listening to me. There are not enough free folk left in Utanyit to hire. The barons, your liegemen, have their own problems, and few workers to spare. Fields everywhere in eastern and northern Erkinland are going to seed unharvested. Skali of Coldskriker's army across the river in Hernesteer has cut a swath through all the border towns near Utanyit, and will probably cross the river soon, having exhausted Luth's country."
"Luth is dead, I am told," Guthwulf said slowly. He himself had been in King Luth's house, the Taig. His blood had flowed hot in his veins as he insulted the sheepherder king in the midst of Luth's own court. That had been a few scant months ago. Why did he feel so terrible now, so unmanned?
"Why are all these villains running away from their rightful homes?"
The castellan looked at him queerly, as though Guthwulf had suddenly asked which direction was up.
"Why? Because of the wars, and looting on their border, the chaos of the Frostmarch, and the White Foxes, of course.